Hello and welcome to Brain Trust Live number 177.
This week on the podcast, the terrorists are out to ruin my birthday, which is just like terrorists to do.
And terrible attacks in Western Europe lead many to the discovery that terrorist attacks are happening constantly and all over the world. Guys, it's a dangerous place out there.
Plus, the fourth GOP debate ends with a sad plea by moderators promising that economic issues can totally be interesting sometimes.
And a knee-jerk Hillary Clinton turns out to sound a lot like Rudy Giuliani at Saturday's super-secret Democratic debate.
Plus, college protests start up in Missouri and then end up with Yale students hating John Calhoun and Chris Christie hating Obama.
And SCOTUS will now determine whether they meant to give us any abortion rights at all.
We'll have all this and more.
This is Brain Trust Live. Hey guys, I'm Brent.
I'm Lila, and you can find us on the web at www.braintrustlive.com.
That's right.
What
we come
week,
to
guys.
You, oh my gosh, with not the greatest news, obviously.
It's like a
but,
full week of terrible news. And
right.
Here's the worst part. All of this terrible news occurred on my birthday.
That's right, yes.
It was the 1 week a year where I get to have a birthday, and also the 1 week a year where we have, like, a major terrorist attack in Europe,
yeah.
And we all have to talk about it.
Yeah. Now, what you obviously all know, because you're alive and in the world, is that there was a terrorist attack in France. What
yes.
you might not know, because you were probably too busy changing your Facebook photos
right.
to be have a French flag overlay,
right.
is that there were terrorist attacks all over the place.
It was like fucking mayhem.
Which is where we're going to start, because we're going to go in sequential. We're going
right.
to go in...
In terrorism sequential order.
Right, exactly. And it didn't start in Paris.
No.
So we're going to start Thursday, which was in Beirut, which maybe you didn't hear about.
Right. Well, you might have heard about it after the fact, because I feel like there was a massive guilt wave where
right.
suddenly we were like Facebook put in their like
right.
check-in thing, which they usually
yes.
use for natural disasters,
right.
and like people were changing their Facebook photos, and then suddenly everyone was like, wait a minute. It's
yeah.
like Baghdad had a terrorist
yeah,
attack.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened.
Like,
nobody cared about anything until Paris, and then everybody had a moment where we were like
oh no.
Damn it.
44 people died in Beirut the day
yeah.
before, and we didn't talk about it. Now we
yeah.
got to talk about it.
Yeah.
So, 44 people died in Beirut on Thursday.
Right.
There were a couple of... There were, I think, five suicide bombers that were initially going to go to a hospital, but then there was too much security at the hospital, so they just went to a busy commercial center and blew themselves up.
Yeah, once you're just a person who has a bomb strapped to you, I mean, it doesn't really go wherever you want.
As long as you cause death and destruction, you're open for whatever.
Yeah.
It was claimed by the Islamic State, and they were carried out in a big Shiite community, which is controlled by Hezbollah. But again, Hezbollah is like a political force there as well, so it's not
yeah.
just a terrorist organization in Lebanon. So it's not like everyone there was like
yeah.
armed and, you know, a rebel.
That should be Hezbollah's tagline.
Right.
We're not just a terrorist organization
anymore. We're not just terrorists anymore.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
11 people there have been arrested. Most of them are Syrian. As you maybe know or don't know, Lebanon and Syria used to be the same country, and Lebanon broke off because it is a majority Christian nation.
Right.
And so they have not been having recently this kind of, you know, civil
right.
war issue. It's been slowly
it
kind of bleeding into their borders.
Not that long ago that you were there having a lovely vacation visiting your
yeah.
parents.
I know. I actually read something about how, I mean, I think one of the reasons we all immediately, like, felt sympathy for France in a way that we couldn't quite muster for the rest of the world is that we, like, Americans know a lot about France. Many of us
sure.
have been to France. It's like,
right.
you know, we romanticize Paris. It's supposed to be this beautiful city of like
as everyone was pointing out, they're our oldest allies.
Exactly.
We sort of exist as a country
right.
in large part due to France's help.
But I have spent more time in Beirut than in Paris. So
sure.
I felt sad about this
yeah.
myself.
Well, of course.
This was,
we should feel sad
I mean,
about
you should
all.
Feel, but I mean,
but
like,
yes,
I, this,
I get it. No,
this,
I get it.
This
yeah.
to me did read sort of similar weight because I know that Lebanon has been struggling to keep themselves out of this whole struggle.
Because
yeah. they don't want to be in a civil war that's serious civil war. Like,
right.
they already did that, and they formed
yeah.
Lebanon, and now it's over.
Yeah.
In any case, there was a big article in the Times about how forgotten Beirut felt in the aftermath of the French attacks.
Yeah.
Because, obviously, like, as soon as the French attacks happened, like, the entire world, like, lit up in French flag colors.
Yeah.
Conveniently, we were at the ready because they're the
same colors
as our
as
own
ours.
Flag.
We
so
didn't have
it
to
wasn't
get
that
new
hard.
Lights
no,
anything.
We didn't have
no.
to buy new lights.
No.
Like, the Empire State Building felt free to just continue on with a patriotic theme.
Yes.
And we could also maybe think it was French. But that was something that, you know, was happening. I think one of the great sort of, like, unequalizers I've noticed in these situations has become Facebook. Because
yes.
the real determination of whether an attack is having a global impact or not is whether Facebook gives you options about things to do. Like, you know, when there's a major earthquake somewhere, they give you the option to check in and say that you're safe.
You couldn't put the Lebanese flag over your Facebook photo.
You couldn't put the Lebanese flag over your Facebook photo. No one was asking people in Lebanon to check in for safety.
Right.
No one was asking Kenyan people to check in for safety.
Right.
And all they did was try to go to fucking school. And then 140 some odd of them
we'll get
died.
There in a second. Yeah. Although we basically just got there.
We just got there. That's the whole story. There was a terrorist attack at a university in Kenya and 147, I think, people died. And that was the day after the Paris attacks, I think. So in any case, but as you probably know, Friday in France, there were, now they're saying 6 locations were attacked. It was kind of confusing in the moment because so many attacks were happening at once that you couldn't...
People were being held hostage. We didn't know whether they were going to get out and how many people in the building had died and where else bombs were going off. And it was
like
chaos,
mayhem.
Which is, you know, what their plan was.
That's terrorizing.
Right.
That's scary.
Yeah.
And so there were gunmen who came in to several restaurants with Kalashnikovs, and then also I think blew themselves up in some of them. There were suicide bombers outside of a big stadium that was having a France Germany like exhibition match, and the president was there, he got evacuated. There was also a band that I had never heard of that now is the most famous band in the world.
Yeah.
That's an American band called Eagles of Death Metal.
They're from Palm Desert.
That's from Palm Desert. Yeah. They're a California-based band.
Where my parents live.
They were having a concert, and that was like a bloodbath because terrorists opened fire on the concert-goers and then held a bunch of them hostage.
Yeah.
That was a nightmare scenario.
Yeah.
I mean, they were all nightmare scenarios, obviously.
All were.
That was specifically, I think, a nightmare scenario because it was like,
there's a crowd of people. Like, that is when I feel like you're just sort of like instinctively the most scared about something like that. I mean, like you said, any of these things would be scary, but like that is just sort of like, oh my, it's the
That's
most
like an outward
feeling
nightmare.
That you can,
Exactly. Yeah. So in any case, obviously, their president, Hollande, declared a state of emergency, closed the borders, put a curfew in place for vehicular traffic, and also people just being on the streets, and then deployed a lot of the military to wander around aimlessly, I assume, and do stuff. And also some of the gunmen were thought to be at large for a while. There are now, you know, talks about them trying to identify all of the people that were involved. Yeah. We're going to get to this in a second. But it's looking like most of them were Europeans. So that's a concerning element that
is
something maybe they could address within their own borders that has to do with what exactly is happening in France that's making young Islamic men want to become terrorists in the country of their own birth.
Yeah.
Anyway, but first, they obviously went to go bomb various ISIS locations because that's your next step.
Quick. They did not waste any time.
Well, they had already been sort of vaguely over there to help us with our various bombing missions. So they were already there. And Hollande obviously is suddenly talking about a lot of conservative plans for things that he could be doing to increase military funding and other things. They want to be able to strip nationals with dual citizenship of their citizenship if they're convicted of a terrorist offense very easily. They want to deport people that they think pose a threat more quickly. They want to, you know, stuff like that.
Yep.
And then they also were trying to push the rest of Europe to deal with arms trafficking a little bit more directly. But then they also got 10 fighter jets out and dropped 20 bombs on Syria. So no one knows what the effect of that was, but we all read that very specific number in the press today. So I guess we were supposed to feel like
Let me tell you what the effect was. The effect was that now ISIS is going to decide to blow more things up, which we're going to get to in a little bit, which is sort of the problem with this whole strategy, which is a longer conversation, but I mean...
Right, it's one that we're going to have after we cover the basic facts, because we have a lot of thoughts.
We have a lot of thoughts. We're sort of rushing through the sort of, like, general news of this, because A, you probably know it, our thoughts are more important than what... Not more important, but, like, that's... you know, what happens in the wake of this is
the question
important.
Now.
Right, that's the question now.
Yeah. Today was the revelation that, as I mentioned a few minutes earlier, that most of the people that they have identified that were involved in these attacks were EU citizens.
Right. At least in France.
In France.
In Beirut, they were Syrian. But that's because
they're next to Syria.
They're right next door,
but,
so they just
I mean,
sort
when
of
we
got
talk
to
about
pop over there.
Blaming Syria for these problems in France and stuff like that. It is certainly part of the same movement, but these are not just like refugees coming in and then committing terrorist attacks. These are homegrown terrorists.
Yes.
And you know, we've had
problems
with that.
We've had our own of those.
Here.
Yeah, exactly.
So there was there was one Syrian passport that got found at a scene somewhere, and everyone was like, oh my god, a Syrian passport. But then it turned out that there was a man arrested in Serbia with the exact same passport. They were both counterfeit passports, basically. So the one Syrian passport that has been linked to the scene was a counterfeit, and then the one Egyptian passport belonged to a victim. So what a mess. But so everyone currently that has been identified to be involved in these attacks is either French or Belgian.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, something important to talk about as we talk about what the longer consequences of colonialism have been in these regions, and why interfering with the Middle East was never going to be just a Middle Eastern problem.
Right, exactly.
Because as we all know, France colonized Syria. I mean, Syria is partially a mess thanks to bizarre borders that were drawn by France and Britain. So, like, these are all things that factor into the decision.
And this is always what
involves France.
And this is always what ISIS has. That's what their game has always been here. It's always been to restore the caliphate, to deal with the countries who they feel like have either taken their lands or have like been in their lands or whatever. Like, which is sort of why, on some level, you and I have always said, and most experts have even said, that America isn't really in this equation. Well, although now we're helping bomb over there. So, of
we're
course,
we're in the equation for economic reasons. We're in the equation for current geopolitical reasons. We're not in the equation for colonial reasons.
Right.
Except that we are the people that are propping up Israel, basically, monetarily and militarily.
Yeah.
So that's the only reason that we're involved in this equation at all. And so, I feel like there was some sort of like instinctive feeling here that this was all like a proxy attack on America, like attacking the West is a proxy attack on America. And that's not what this is about. This was a proxy attack on all of the West and the influence that they have been having in the Middle East and the destabilizing influence that they've been in the Middle East. But this is a lot about how Europe specifically has sort of like caused, wreaked havoc in the Middle East and helped us destabilize the entire region. That's, I think, part of why France is getting the brunt of this.
Yeah.
Also, now they're threatening to attack Washington. What else?
Yeah, there was a new video that came out today, actually, I think, where they said, we say to the states that take part in the Crusader campaign that by God you will have a day, God willing, like France's, and by God, as we struck France in the center of its abode in Paris, then we swear that we will strike America at its center in Washington. So they're basically threatening an attack similar to this in Washington, D.C.
So now we can all live with fear also.
Yes.
I mean, this is the intention of terrorism, is to spread fear.
It is.
It's not just to spread death and destruction. So that is what their game plan is here.
Yeah.
I think the sort of the worst thing that I think we can do in America is let ourselves get consumed by the kind of fear-based propaganda that we did after 9/11, because that is what caused this problem in the first place, in part.
Totally.
I mean, this is an outgrowth of us destabilizing a region that we destabilized in response to an attack that it also didn't really have anything to do with, but more importantly, an attack that we sort of like used for sort of political gains that were not directly related to our safety and stability.
Correct.
So
I
think, this concerns me because I specifically remember what it was like to live in a place where a terrorist attack was around every corner.
Sure.
And that was not a comfortable way to live or a productive way to live, but it also it made people's judgment bad in every way. And it also
It just causes overreaction at like its most
and it also
extreme.
It turned me into a victim of both terrorism and like crazy Americans overreacting to terrorism, because suddenly a war was being waged in the name of these people in Lower Manhattan who did not want a war to be waged in their name.
Yeah.
And I feel like that is kind of what, if suddenly a war is waged in the name of the residents of D.C. who are like, the last thing we need is to generate more cause for concern for terrorist activities because we live in the Capitol.
Yeah.
Like that, I feel like. Anyway, so everyone keep your shit together in the aftermath of this. Especially if you live in a state where your governor has decided they're going to stop taking Syrian refugees.
Right.
Here's one thing, Syrian refugees are fleeing a situation that we helped create that is destabilizing in their own country, that is for their own safety. Like, they are not coming here to attack us. They're coming here because we attacked them, and now their whole fucking life is messed
up. Exactly. And I do think that I think the point of this, and in no way am I sticking up for these people, because they're bonkers and we should take these Syrian refugees. But I think that what their point is that terrorists would attempt to exploit the system. And I think there may be some of that. And I do think that obviously you have to screen these people, but we would screen these people anyway. Right. So I like to say that you're not going to have them in your state is ridiculous. And also whenever we take refugees in, you can't force them to not leave wherever they go anyway. So if California says we're going to take 65,000 Syrian refugees, which we've already said we're going to take however many, we didn't say that many, but because I think Obama has only said 10,000 anyway.
Right.
But they could leave here and go to Alabama anyway, and there would be no way for Alabama to do anything about that anyway. So like, this is all ridiculous. And also there's no basis for these governors to be able to say that they can't come anyway. If the United States is taking these refugees, governors can't say we're not taking them. They don't have any say in where these people are settling.
They are saying we're going to do everything in our power. But here's why they're saying it. Because they're all, except for one, Republicans, and four of them are running for president or were running for president.
Exactly. And it's a lot, too. It's like now I think over half of our governors have said that they don't want any of the Syrian refugees. I mean, it's...
But, like, calm down, Kansas.
I know. Nobody wants to go there
wants to go to Kansas. God. If you end up in Kansas, it's not... It's not worth terror attacking Kansas.
I was going to say.
It's bad enough.
First off, no terrorists are going to...
They're terror attacking themselves currently by living there.
Like, yeah, exactly. I know.
Like,
yeah.
Calm right down.
Yeah. If you voted for Sam Brownback, then that's its own brand of...
You terrorized yourself already this year.
Bingo.
So,
yeah.
Don't try to blame Syrians for your trouble. It's so rude.
No, it is. Yeah. But, you know, I mean... Bobby Jindal, of course, running for president. Chris Christie, John Kasich, you know, all of the Republican governors who are running for president quick got on this train. But so did all of the Republican governors. I mean, it wasn't it wasn't just them. I mean, it was Arizona, Arkansas, Florida. I mean, I'm not going to read all the names
because we'd be here all night.
It's all the states. There was only one Democrat, and it's New Hampshire. Again, nobody's trying to go there either. But
also, New Hampshire, that's not surprising because New Hampshire is fairly libertarian and fair. True. Like, that it. Not dealing with outside world problems is part of their state's, you know.
Yeah. But plan. even Rick Scott, who's no genius, said that he doesn't think that he has the authority to keep the federal government from resettling people there, although he's one of the ones who said that he didn't want to take any of them. But at least I'm surprised that it's Rick Scott of all of these people who sort of is acknowledging reality, because he's not a real
thought. I want to talk about which states these are, because they are by and large states... besides Florida, that don't have large immigrant populations anyway.
Right.
Like, they're states where the fear of others is already fairly strong.
Yeah. Now, there are some, I mean, because there's a map of places where some of these people have settled, and it's always weird where people end up settling. It doesn't
refugees end up in weird states.
It doesn't make sense necessarily. I'm from Iowa. We have a huge Sudanese population in Iowa, which is like... why is that happening?
Because there was room in Iowa for Sudanese people to come.
And there's a huge Syrian population in Michigan.
Right,
And the Michigan governor is a Republican, and he's one of the ones who said that he didn't want to take any of those refugees. So, like, that is sort of an issue, because you would think that they would probably want to settle where there are already people who...
Yeah.
So if the governor of Michigan is trying to make it impossible for Syrians to get there, like, maybe that's not great, because they might want to go there.
Right.
But beyond that, it's like, none of these places are like, I mean... get real, North Carolina.
Right.
Like, I mean,
just... calm yourself right down.
Yeah.
No, it's like, it's always, it's places that are not accustomed to living in a world in which you don't know who's coming, but everyone is coming, that really respond to the fear factor in these situations.
Yeah.
Because, like, despite knowing that there, you know, that people who committed 9/11 obviously could get in and out of New York, or were being allowed to fly to make pretend New York or out of New York or whatever, like, I would never in a million years think to myself, like, well, we should stop letting immigrants from the Middle East into New York. That would be a crazy thought.
Right?
Like, that's an insane-o thought.
Yeah.
But, like, that's not an insane thought if you don't allow any immigrants in, because no one's trying to come, so maybe not.
Exactly.
Also, I have... some more thoughts generally about what effective and ineffective ways to fight terrorism are. Because I think one of the things that this has sort of highlighted in addition to just being, like, generally scary because mayhem seems to be around every corner, is that the terrorism that we're fighting is a sort of decentralized, very kind of, like, internet organized, like, unfocused version of terrorism. Yes. And that's part of what makes it so hard to fight, is... it's sort of like a lot of people independently deciding they've had it up to here, who are like loosely affiliated with this crazy pants movement, yes, and like don't necessarily fully understand what they've gotten themselves into, and yeah, like are have a variety of aims in terms of carrying out these acts. I mean, if we're saying that all of these people that carried out these attacks in France were European citizens, then these are not people that were just fleeing Syria recently in the right wave of these attacks. These are people that felt like their life in France and Belgium was not worth having, which is a different kind of problem.
Yeah.
But because of that, I feel like I've been thinking, you know, we always respond militarily, and I've been thinking about why it is that, you know, why we lost Vietnam and why we won the American Revolution. These are the two wars that I've been thinking about recently. Because the reason that we lost Vietnam was because we went in like an organized Western military force and they were fucking everywhere at every turn and we yep didn't know what to do.
Yep.
And the reason that we won the American Revolution is because the very rigid British did not know what to do with us because we were like jumping out of trees and killing them.
Yeah.
And like that was not how wars were fought at that
and
time.
And the French were helping us.
And the French were helping us. Right. But I mean, like the strategy yes that caused us to win in that context and lose in this other context was yep just that like we were fighting with the wrong mentality. We were fighting an organized war against disorganized people, or they were fighting an organized war against us and we're disorganized people, or whatever it was.
Right.
But I feel like that's part of why the way that we've responded thus far to these attacks has, or that to this situation in general,
yes,
and to the Middle East in general,
yeah,
has been so misguided, because this is not,
totally
it's not
agree
like everyone in the Middle East is sitting around being like, well, I just hate America because of hating everyone, because
no,
I hate people
not
and I want people to die.
No.
Like, they're sitting around thinking, this region of the world has made our lives harder,
yes,
and we now are susceptible to this rhetoric that, you know, that is vaguely extremist because our lives are extreme,
yeah,
and we need to do something extreme to fix our lives. And like, that is something that you have to fight differently than just being like bombing places and hoping that's enough. Like, that's a larger problem. And in Europe, it's a larger problem with treating the immigrant populations that are already there better.
Yeah.
Because France is one of the most racist countries on earth. Everybody knows that about France. Like, this is a long-standing problem of France's. Like, this is a problem they've had since, you know, since Tunisians were coming at every turn.
Sure.
This is a problem they've had
yeah
with anyone from the Middle East coming, but also anyone from anywhere.
Yeah.
Because French people are vaguely, they're very proud of being French. They
yes
are very unproud of having everyone. I mean, you know, we the headscarf battles in the French schools.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah,
we've seen
that's right, of
we've
course
seen waves
yes, yes,
and
yes,
waves
yes
of this problem in France. And that's, you know, I think part of what happened, you know, in when was it in January when Charlie the Je suis
oh, yeah
Charlie
yeah
situation
Charlie Hebdo yes
the Je suis Charlie situation broke out. But I mean, I feel like there are some things that we have to do in a slightly more sort of, and I use guerrilla to mean sort of grassroots level manner
yes
to address some of these problems
yes
because this is not making me feel safer
no
to address these problems militarily, and it's because the problems aren't military in nature.
No. Well, and you know, and you and I were talking about this too, and I was actually even talking to my mom about this. There have been a lot of articles recently, you know, just even within the last couple of days where, you know, I like obviously what we've been doing for the last 15 years, and as you rightly pointed
right
out, longer than that, the last however,
the last,
God knows
since
how
colonialism
long
started.
Since colonialism started, right, is not it's not working.
It's not working.
Like, this is not...
No.
It's, whatever we're doing is not the answer. So,
and it's like, to the just from a purely selfish standpoint, it's not making me feel safer.
No.
I don't feel safer knowing that we're bombing people in the Middle East.
No.
I don't feel safer knowing that we're, like, giving people who are happen to be from the Middle East a hard time in the U.S.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not trying to see my friends who appear vaguely Middle Eastern, like, just having a hard time, because I would be angry if that were happening to me too.
Yeah, of course.
Like, that is,
and that's
I mean,
what that's what breeds
breeds resentment and anger. Yeah, I mean
yeah
that's it's not the same mentality that's causing white men to shoot up entire schools.
Right.
That's another problem
now,
that we could be addressing. But I mean, like, this is something that happens because of a concerted effort to like to not treat certain people the same way that we want to be, you know,
I
the way that we
agree
want to be treated.
And you what you're hearing now, especially from Republicans, but even from some Democrats
yeah
too, is that you just, you know, you have to defeat them. And
right,
you know,
this
I,
is
I think
not
that
a
I even heard somebody
defeating
I heard
anyone.
I heard someone recently, and I it was a I can't remember who it was, but I think it was a Democrat, but basically saying that, like, because ISIS is a little bit different, because they are basically sort of, like, you know, they're mostly focused on sort of, like, you know, reestablishing the caliphate and, like, actually, like, taking over sort of,
land in the Middle East,
is that they might be able to be defeated in a different way. But, like, I just still don't think that's accurate, because you're still going to be, because if you continue to bomb them, if you continue to do all of the things that you have been doing, it's only going to breed more of this type of thing. There may be some merit to, like, taking back some of that land, but, like, then also, like, it's still, you've just got
people correct. In the name of ideological issues, because ISIS is not just a random, you know, renegade power hungry guy who's, like, kind of charming and hoping to take over power. Like, they have a very serious ideological bent that is different than the governing principle of the rest of the Middle East, and is in contrast to that principle. They are not pleasant people to live under. People are not trying to live under them unless their option is to live under constant fear of some other attack. I mean, they're replacing another evil. So it's not just a matter of, like, deciding that they're just, like, really good militarily and we're just going to, like, deal with land issues. Right. Because to some degree, like, there has to be some sort of passive consent to allow them to keep recruiting people and for this to keep happening.
Yeah.
Also, Anonymous decided to declare war on ISIS, which I think is probably the most effective strategy we could currently have.
That's going to be better than anything that any bomb.
I mean, it's going to be better than any bomb. They really are the first sort of, like, large-scale political movement like this to operate with such an intense focus on social media and the internet. Yeah. So this is different for that reason as well. Their rhetoric is spreading in a different way than what we're thinking, than we're acting like it's spreading.
Yep.
And that's why I feel like there are larger issues to address. Evil people come to power because other people are desperate. They don't come to power because people love living under harsh regimes.
And because they can, because there's a power vacuum.
Yeah, they come to power in power vacuums, and when other people are like, well, everything fucking sucks.
Yeah.
Like, talk to Germany about how that happened. I've been feeling so down on Germany for the last few months.
Hey, they're taking the Syrian refugees.
The whole world is turning to shit. Now that Germany's taking all the refugees.
Yeah.
Like, I can't even figure out what I think anymore. It's chaos.
That's something.
I just don't want to live, overall, I don't want to live in a world that is defined by the kind of fear that the 10 years following 9/11 were defined by.
Well, it's 1984.
It's
Orwellian.
It's totally.
The world that we're living in.
And I'm bored of that. I'm tired from it. I'm exhausted from it.
Like, I even had a moment where I was, like, on Friday, like, in the evening when I got home and I was watching, like, all the French, like, terror attack stuff, I was like, I mean, I was watching it voluntarily, but, like, I also felt like it was sort of, like, being forced to watch the Daily Hate.
Yeah.
You know, like, just sort of, like, this unnamed villain that we're fighting now that, like, I just am forced to be scared of all the time. And it's like, that's
too tiring to be scared all the time. Yeah. And you don't have to live, like, there's no reason. We drive in cars all the time, every day. Those are very scary, and we don't live in fear of driving in cars all day, but, like, we have to live in fear of this unknown, like, it's why it makes everyone act crazy. I can't deal with people who are acting crazy all the time about terrorism.
Well, and that's what terrorism is supposed to do. Yeah. So if you are actually living it that way, then they're doing it right.
Which, exactly.
Then, like, let's not let them do
they're
that.
They're winning.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Obama gave a speech. He's at the G20 summit this week. He gave a speech today in Turkey that was sort of like, chill the fuck out, everybody. Like,
because everybody immediately was like, what are we going to be? Everything that we're doing? Right. Exactly. Yeah.
Was America's first question.
We shouldn't.
He was like, no, we should not just invade somebody. That's not what you do.
Yeah.
He said, you know, he also was very much like, we can't not accept refugees just because this situation has happened. Well, it is not refugees' fault that they're being co-opted this way, but also they're like human beings who need a place to go.
Yeah.
We can't just pretend that's not true. We need coalitions to help us fight terrorism. We Americans can't keep acting unilaterally like we had been, the rest of the world also needs to step up, because a lot of these countries in Europe that were not part of our initial sort of like stupid forays into the Middle East still have some sort of, you know, connection to this situation, and you know, we need to think of ways to fight this together as opposed to us being stupid or them being stupid or someone being stupid. But he also said, like, that he's not planning to put boots on the ground. That we're going to keep doing airstrikes, but he's not trying to invade Syria now that this has happened.
Yeah.
And that we need to act intelligently and make sure that we're strategic and not just, like, fighting random wars to look tough.
Right.
He did say something about not trying to fight just to look tough. I was, like, into that.
Yeah, I like that. He also, I love, the Democrats recently have been really referencing George W. Bush. They did it at the debate the other night, too, because, of course, everyone wants to sort of, like, somehow this attack has caused us to, like, all collectively, like, want to decide that it's now okay to say, extremist Islam or whatever, you know? And so, of course, the Democrats are sort of, like, rightly invoking George W. Bush after 9/11 when he would not do that because he was like, I don't want to, like, demonize this,
we're not
an entire
fighting Islam,
religion.
We're fighting extremists.
Yeah.
But so now we're all talking about...
Obama did the same thing in this
We're talking about the one, like, not evil thing that George Bush did, basically. It's not even a heroic thing. It's just sort of like a one not horrible thing that he did.
Yeah.
So... And of course, I mean, aside from accomplishing the mission.
Yes.
Aside from taking pictures in front of a mission accomplished sign, which let us all know that we had won.
Yeah.
Also, now the presidential race is all about terrorism.
Oh,
and
my God.
So
I know.
Stupid.
Well, and this, and again, we were talking about this earlier today, and I just, like, it's frustrating to me because obviously these terror attacks are terrible, and we sort of, I think, probably rightly have to talk about it, and it's important that we talk about what to do and who is the best equipped to sort of make the right decisions on this. But, like, also, like, this is not what our presidential election should be about. Like, I get that, like, it has to be a part of it. I'm not delusional here, but, like we are not at a time and place in our country where, like, I want to be deciding who's going to be the next president based on who
is going
to make
them in a war.
Fighting ISIS. Like, certainly they have to be capable. I would contend that any of them, maybe not on the Republican side, but even some of them on the Republican side would be able to sort of, like, make an informed enough decision on that. Like, we need to still be focused on, like, what ideas these people have about things that, like, are going to affect
also,
our daily life.
Yeah,
and that
there
this,
are domestic
this is not
issues
that,
that
this
we
is not that.
Need to have addressed here.
Right.
We have we have huge income disparities in this country.
Right.
We're just recovering from a recession that was caused by stupid Republican financial planning and banks that are too big, and I'm like, we have things that we need to address in this nation from a domestic point of view, and we got away with not addressing a lot of them because of 9/11 for years.
Totally.
We got away with not doing anything productive at the domestic level. We finally, when we elected Obama, sort of started to overcome that problem, but we cannot afford to go back.
No, we can't.
And especially not over a terrorist attack that occurred in France.
Thank you.
Like,
yeah, I mean, tragic, but I mean, like...
Tragic, it's important that we figure out how we sort of, like, respond to that kind of situation.
Yeah.
It's important that we make sure that we're as safe as we can be. It is not important that we give up all of our political discourse to this topic, though. That is not... That is letting the terrorists win.
Yeah.
I'm into things that are letting the terrorists win this week, because I felt like after 9/11... Everyone was just constantly letting the terrorists win at every turn.
Yeah.
Like, the terrorists were winning because we were getting bomb threats at my high school that we were considering credible.
Yeah.
Like, the terrorists were winning because the subway kept getting closed down because of anonymous threats.
Right.
And the terrorists were winning because I had to be scared of anthrax all of a sudden.
And
I was like, what the fuck is this?
And they really win if that's how we're going to decide to elect a fucking leader of the free world.
Yeah.
Like,
they won when we reelected George Bush.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not how we should decide to continue to let our lives go on.
Yeah. But I did, you know, the GOP, certainly two of the people who we can't trust to make informed decisions on this are...
The two frontrunners in the GOP.
Ben Carson, who has, you know, claimed recently that China is becoming involved in Syria, which
that's
not
incorrect.
And Donald Trump also suggested the battle against the Islamic State could be left to Russia, which, I mean...
I would not...
I'd be fine with, like, letting Russia do it. I don't necessarily
trust
know
that,
they
would.
Like, Russia is going to do it. And I think that, like, if Russia is just going to continue to, like, bomb Syria and also...
And then sell them arms.
And sell them arms and continue to support Assad, that maybe that is not the way to go.
Right.
But, I think that that they are maybe not to be trusted. I think that the person that I would trust the most, and I even said this to my mom earlier today, and she sort of, like, didn't really take very kindly to it, but I was like, if we're going to sit around and, like, be forced to decide this next presidential election on who is best equipped to deal
with
this
just
right
this
now,
issue?
Then I'm voting for Rand Paul. And I've been threatening it for years.
Right.
But like, if everybody can't... if everybody's gonna run around with their fucking hair on fire and like screaming like banshees,
right?
Then like, that's where I'm.
I want an isolationist,
right? Like, I mean, I'm there. I'm with him. But like, I just like, this needs to not be what we're all focused on right now, because it's not the most important thing. It's the most important thing right now, but it's not why, it's not the reason
why
we
elect a president.
Correct.
It's not,
it's just not.
And it sort of, it allows a certain kind of discourse that is largely symbolic and has nothing to do with anything to reign,
totally.
Which is not something that I'm on board with.
Yep. Agreed.
Also, it allows Jeb Bush to say things like that we should resume NSA surveillance.
Sure.
He's full of good ideas, that guy.
He really is.
He's full of thoughts. Uh-huh. He was on Morning Joe today, and he said, I think we need to restore the metadata program, which was part of the Patriot Act. I think it was a useful tool to keep us safe and also protect civil liberties.
To protect civil liberties?
Isn't that hilarious?
Well, that's questionable.
So basically, the program's going to expire.
We could debate whether it was keeping us safe or
right.
not. I would say no.
We can't debate whether it protects civil liberties.
No, because it's...
been decided.
Right, exactly.
The program is going to expire in November, but in May, an appeals court ruled that it was illegal. So the NSA has had a 6-month deadline to craft a more narrowly tailored program, so that they have to get prior approval to receive data now. But I love, he said, the threat of global Islamic terrorism is a real one for our country. There's a lot riding on this. So I think we can have a proper balance of protecting privacy rights and making sure we use all the tools of intelligence to keep us safe.
But you're
which
not
I
wanting
would agree with.
But you're not wanting to protect our privacy rights.
The one thing we've decided as a nation is that that NSA surveillance program was not... Right. Protecting our privacy.
Right, exactly. Like, he suggested having a proper balance, actually suggesting is an improper balance. Like,
the thing that he's suggesting is the one thing that program didn't offer.
Bingo.
Like, I also agree with that statement, if you don't hear it in the context of his first statement.
Yeah.
Also, in May, he also had said that there's no evidence, not a shred of evidence, that the metadata program has violated anyone's civil liberties.
But
which,
it
again,
violated everyone's.
We have actual proof of that, because the Edward Snowden leaks showed us definitive proof that they were, in fact, violating civil liberties. That's what he did.
Right.
That's why people who are super into secret government programs were angry at him, because he had secret, you know, government evidence that we were violating people's civil liberties. Yeah. Ugh, these people. Also, now Harvard got evacuated today with a bomb. Like, now we're going to have bomb threats all the time. Guys, I can't go back to the days when we had to get evacuated constantly. Let me tell you a story. Okay. This was pre 9/11 by several years.
Oh, my.
But in my high school.
I wasn't expecting that.
No, I know. It's a story about how evacuating can be fun, but then ultimately become a burden. We had someone who was setting...
Oh, I heard this story.
Who was setting bathroom fires every single day.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I went to a school that was supposedly for gifted people, but some of them were gifted in the wrong ways.
Like Ben Carson gifted.
Right. Thankfully, I don't know any Ben Carson gifted people. I do just know... I know some unhappy gifted people. In any case, one of them was setting bathroom fires in our school every day.
Yeah.
And so... At first, we'd evacuate the whole school, but then it got to the point where it was, like, happening so often that we started just evacuating certain floors, and you would just, like, sometimes you'd smell smoke, and you'd just wait and see if you were one of the floors that was going to be evacuated, and we were evacuating all... We got to know our escape route, like, really well. And at first, it was fun, and you got to miss class,
yeah, you
and sometimes
class.
You got to go home early, like, it was
win.
Super fun for a while,
then
and then
annoying.
At a certain point, it was like... Really? Fifth and sixth period we're going to evacuate? Who has the time? Or it would be really annoying if they evacuated during your lunch period,
right.
And you'd be like, I missed the evacuation.
Or it's cold.
Or it's cold out.
Raining.
And you didn't have a coat. Like, it was a mess.
Yeah.
And eventually we learned that not all evacuations are fun evacuations. And that sometimes you just have to live with not evacuating at every turn over vague threats. Now, because there were actual fires being set, I would contend that they were right to evacuate us in that situation. But what I will say...
The burning might build down.
Right.
Burn down.
Right. What I will say is that I don't want to go back to the days where every time someone sees an empty box somewhere, we have to evacuate everywhere.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, I'm not trying to, like, start evacuating the subway at every turn.
Right.
Like,
or somebody brings a clock to school.
Somebody brings a clock to school, and that person who brings the clock happens to not be white, and then we all have to panic because, you know... Because America.
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
We've got to nip it in the bud.
Yeah. Oh, boy.
Also, I love the thought that it obviously ran through someone's mind that the next stop after attacking Paris would be Harvard. Like, that's what I always felt was funny at Stuyvesant, is that there was a reporter who came into our school on 9/11 and said that there was a bomb. And this was after we had evacuated or whatever. Someone reported from our school that there was also a bomb threat at our school. And I was like, And then when we returned to school after 9/11, there was a big sign that said, and Stuyvesant is now more famous than anyone wants it to be. So wear your ID at all time because we don't know what's going to happen.
That's right. You had ideas after.
Yeah. And I was sort of like, someone in someone's mind, they were like, well, they did the World Trade Center. What could be next but Stuyvesant High School? Like a public high school is the next stop. Like, that's bananas. In any case, moving on.
Oh,
we also mentioned that there were attacks in Kenya. 147 people died in an attack on a university.
Yeah.
Interestingly, I will say the one upside of all of these happening at the same time was that the Kenya and Beirut attacks ended up getting a lot more media than they would have otherwise.
Probably
because
so, yes.
They would have been completely ignored if we hadn't all been reeling from Paris.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
True. And like, by the way, I get it. Like I said, we know Paris. We, like, instinctively yes. understand what it is to be in a place like Paris,
yeah.
where you feel safe and everyone's eating baguettes and drinking wine and, like, you're riding on a bicycle with a scarf or whatever. Like,
yeah.
we have romanticized Paris to a degree that this sort of, like, we don't like real-life things to happen in Paris because Paris is where our, like, storybook romances go, you know?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So, I get it. I just, I'm like, let's think critically about our next steps here,
let's.
Guys.
Yeah.
Because agreed. If just Beirut and Kenya had happened, we wouldn't be thinking about whether we should bomb anyone.
Yeah.
We would have just been like, well, you shouldn't live in Kenya then if you don't want to be killed in a university attack.
Right.
Like, anyway, yeah. here's what we actually wanted to talk about.
Back to domestic.
Because, guys, we hate talking about foreign politics.
That was like 30 minutes of pain for us right there. We did
the
our best.
We did our best. Well, and I just like descend into rants when we talk about foreign policy.
No, it's the,
I have a lot of anger about foreign policy.
It's the only way.
Domestic policy I can have a sense of humor about because I ultimately participate in it.
Right,
whereas foreign policy I often feel very powerless in discussing. And I'm often like, I can't, like, as someone who has been personally affected by foreign policy in a very direct way, I feel often like, much more powerless about that than I do about whether or not we can pass healthcare reform. You know, like, that's something I feel like I could work towards.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know what to do about not going to war in the Middle East.
Yeah.
In any case, the RNC had a debate on Tuesday.
Yes, their fourth,
their
number four.
400th, that was on Fox Business.
Fox Business.
The moderators got better reviewed than the CNBC moderators.
Yes.
Because they were still, by the way, I watched the debate, terrible.
I agree.
It was nobody can control this crowd.
No, they can't.
I don't know why. Like, they were better in that they didn't completely lose their train of thought, and the whole field didn't descend into crazy bickering where they were all talking over each other.
Right.
I wouldn't call that a success.
I was going to say that's what, at least that's what we are looking for in these debates.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was a far less entertaining debate than the CNBC debate.
Yeah.
And honestly, when your front runners are Trump and Ben Carson, as I think I said during the third debate,
I mean, come on.
That's all that we're here for. We're not here for a substantial policy discussion does not happen when the two front runners are loon bags. So,
that's right.
Like at that point, it better be entertaining.
Yeah.
In any case, it wasn't a super exciting debate. I have some theories as to why. The first being that it was supposed to be about economic issues and those are not interesting.
Right.
Especially when you talk to Republicans about them. They're interesting when you talk to Democrats.
Yeah.
We talked about that at the Democratic debate that was on Saturday that we'll tell you about
in a second.
And that was interesting. What's not interesting is eight guys all saying that you need to cut taxes and, you know, balance the budget 1,000 times and then being like, that's the only key to prosperity.
Yeah.
Even though we've definitively proven that their exact plans do not lead to prosperity.
Right, exactly.
Like, time and again.
Yeah. My favorite moment, and this is also sort of like just going back to the, you know, foreign policy debate, but like, my favorite moment of that debate was the Rand Paul and Marco Rubio standoff over Rand Paul. I mean, like, I think they both had good moments in that standoff there because, you know, if you're a person who is a Rand Paul sort of style libertarian Republican, then, like, he killed that. And if you're a Republican who wants to blow all of the world up, then you were really with Marco Rubio on that. So it was sort of a fascinating exchange because I feel like they both got
in their blows. Yeah.
Sort of, but like it was certainly the best moment that Rand Paul had in all four of the debates because in that third debate, I hardly felt like he was speaking.
He was barely there.
I think I even was.
He even commented that he was barely there.
I was declaring that he was going to be out by the end of the week because everybody was sort of declaring that that was. I mean, I wasn't going on a limb on that there, but I mean, like, a lot of people were sort of like, oh, does he even really care? And he really sort of like came to play in this debate. And I don't know if it, I don't know how much it can help him. Yeah. I feel like on some level, it might help him in the wake of these terrorist attacks, just because I feel like he is sort of like, I think he speaks the most intelligently on how we got here, what we can do, what we shouldn't be doing.
Also, I think there is a sort of pocket of isolationism in the Republican Party that these let's bomb them to the next century people are never going to be able to capture.
Yeah.
You know, their isolationist policy is also not a Democratic strategy. No, we're diplomats. We want to engage with the rest of the world. We just don't want to bomb them necessarily, right, unless we're Hillary Clinton and then we vote for the Iraq War.
Right.
But my point is that Rand Paul represents something that is ultimately like a very conservative stance. Isolationism is an old school conservative policy. Right. And he said that at the debate.
What I thought was like the most sort of like, it's the most coherent that he has been on the debate stage about this, where he really turned it into a, can you be a conservative if you are wanting to spend $1 trillion on a war, which is exactly what he said to Marco Rubio.
And exactly.
Rubio, I thought, had a really good response to it. I mean, for a person who
wants to spend $1 trillion to go to war.
Right, exactly. I mean, he stuck up for it in a way that, like, made sense to people who probably think that. So I thought that was a fun exchange. Just
and
it also illustrates
the degree to which that party is all over the place right now.
Totally.
Like, that was like having a general election debate about foreign policy, except that nobody had a good idea fully.
Yeah.
Like, no one went full good idea.
Right. Well, and what's interesting, too, is that, you know, I mean, I don't really know that we totally know what Donald Trump's foreign policy would be because he's bonkers.
A wild card.
And I don't think that he knows either.
Though but it's my, fairly isolationist.
I was going to say, if you had to put him on the scale of Marco Rubio and Rand Paul, he's inching closer to Rand Paul than he
absolutely
is to Marco Rubio.
So he's against free trade. He's trying to keep all the immigrants out.
Right.
Like, those are not policies of someone who's trying to engage in the world.
Exactly. I think that if the Republicans continue to talk about terrorism, to talk about how they're going to respond to this, I think that could become more interesting with the Republican Party than it probably actually is in the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
Because I think they're mostly on the same page, other than Hillary Clinton, who is a warmonger.
She's sort of rhetorically on the same page. She's just having to answer for these terrible mistakes because she's secretly on the wrong page.
Bingo. Yeah.
But in any case, to see this
play out with the Republicans could be fascinating.
Very fascinating. Yeah. Especially this year where there's so many of them to come down in weird parts of the aisle that you're like, I would never have guessed.
What does
Ben Carson think about any of this? Nobody, you can only guess. You don't know. Also, the person who was sort of like, by and large, considered the winner of this debate, not a winner in the sense that anyone thought that he like blew them all away, but a winner in that he gained the most from it was Ted Cruz.
Yeah.
He by far got the most speaking time by like over 2 minutes.
Right.
And that's contrasted to Ben Carson got the least speaking time. He got 9 minutes and 22 seconds of time. Cruz got 13 minutes and 35 seconds of time.
Yeah.
He like went on like a full 4 to 5 minutes longer than Ben Carson.
Yeah.
And then Trump, who normally gets all the time because he's a blowhard who just never stops talking, was in third place behind Kasich and Cruz. So he was not overshadowing everyone as much in this debate. He got a few, a few jabs in.
Yeah.
But he was, and also he sounded crazy and out of touch.
He did.
He didn't sound like a normal person.
Yeah. Well, and Kasich had a lot of speaking time, but it was also everything that I saw was that all of the Republican voters who they polled after this was that he did the worst job. I mean, he did the best job, but that's because he sounded the most reasonable, but that's not what they're looking for.
Nope.
They're not looking for
reasonable. And it was largely them stumping. I mean, the questions were not probing questions, and all of the sort of follow-ups ended up coming from other candidates, basically.
Well, and that's the thing that I think is going to...
Classic Fox.
But also, you know, I think about it also, it's never going to sound like anything other than a stump speech. When you look at, like, the person who spoke the most was 13 minutes.
Yeah.
I mean, that's shorter than a stump speech. So you're only... Yes, you're asking them specific questions, but they're only answering in... You know, and they're only answering in sound bites.
Yeah.
And that's what I thought, you know, we're going to talk about the Democratic debate next. But I mean, like, those people at the Democratic debate sounded like three people who were having, like, a discussion amongst themselves. Granted, it was being moderated, but, like, people who sort of, like, were people who all are totally fit to be president. I mean, whether you like Hillary Clinton or not, or like Bernie Sanders or not, but I mean, like, they all...
Everyone seemed like a thoughtful human being who has thoughts.
Correct. And I'm not saying the Republicans I am saying the Republicans aren't like that. But what I'm saying, we can't be for sure. Right, exactly.
We can never find out.
Until there are less than eight of them, then we're never going to know because they're never going to speak in anything other than platitudes and soundbites.
People were saying that Christie was the standout of the kitty debate, and I was like, he's already been in the big kid debate. He can't pull a Fiorina and get into the big kid debate after already getting kicked out of it.
Right.
You guys have to stop yourselves at some point.
Yeah.
You can't shuffle up this much. Also, I would like to point out a few things. One of which is that Marco Rubio, as much as like his actual words sounded like the most sort of Republican establishment, ideal, he sounded so rehearsed and robotic through the entire thing that I was like losing track of whether he's a real human being or not at various points.
Well, even his response to Rand Paul was good, but it seemed rehearsed because he was like,
he felt very rehearsed.
He goes, I think that America, and then he stops himself and he goes, no, I know that America. Right. But it was so stilted.
It was like, wait, I forgot my line.
Yes, exactly. That's totally what it
was. There was also a line where Ted Cruz said he was going to get rid of five agencies, but could only name four.
He
named the Department of Commerce twice. He had a Rick Perry moment. He named five, but two of them were the Department of Commerce.
Well, that's important.
But overall, there were more speaking gaffes, like awkward speaking gaffes, than I've heard in a long time at a debate. And I think it's because everyone sounded so rehearsed that they were like, you knew where they were going, and they knew where they were going, because we all knew what they were going to say before they said it. And so it didn't matter if they said it correctly or not. So sometimes they would just leave out words, and you'd be like, no, this is not how English is spoken. You didn't actually say this, but then everyone would sort of like sheep, we'd all be like, yes, you know, because we knew where they were heading already, because we'd already heard the talking point 500 times. Then the Democrats were like, hey, let's hold a top secret debate on Saturday that no one will know about.
Yeah.
It'll be at 9 Eastern on a Saturday night, and we're not going to cancel it because of these terrorist attacks. We're going to let that further give us cover as we provide this debate that only Brent Thornburg will watch.
I did, and I watched it. And I got to say, it's interesting because I feel like a lot of the debate coverage that happened after this was that it was like not a great debate for the Democrats, and I wholly disagree because I watched every second of it, and like certainly there were issues. I mean, a lot of people sort of, you know, said that maybe Sanders wasn't great on talking about Paris and terrorism, and Hillary Clinton obviously had her gaffe, which we're going to get to in a little bit, and a lot of people sort of thought maybe O'Malley won, but like also who gives a rip whether Martin O'Malley won or not. But like I felt like when they got into the meat of talking about the economy, like Sanders really, really crushed it in a very real way, better than he has done, I think, ever before, at least in front of a large stage. Because, like, he really, there were so many moments, and he had a lot of applause, too, more so than any of the others, I think. And not just because I have a bumper sticker that says Bernie Sanders on my car, but, like, he really sort of, like,
he's offering the most exciting vision, of course.
Most exciting vision, and very, very coherently was able to explain it better than I think that he was able to do in that first debate, where he sort of was good, but also sort of, like, I don't really think necessarily was, like, concisely able to, like, say things. But, like,
he's not a concise man.
Every time that he spoke made me think, like, the things that he is saying right now are the reasons that, like, I have always felt like I was a Democrat. I was watching this with one of my best friends. I was watching it with Whitney, and who is a longtime Clinton supporter, voted for her in 2008, loves Clinton. And I kid you not, after this debate, he was like, I really feel like I have to start rethinking this.
I had friends who were also, like, who are Clinton supporters who have been sort of, like, debating with me this whole time about whether this is the Sanders thing is a legitimate thing to whatever. And I got text messages that were like, I see what the Sanders thing is about.
Yes, exactly. That's what it is. Even if you choose to not vote for him, which I think is a mistake.
Right. But if you're going to choose that.
But, like, it was the most coherent vision for why Democrats are Democrats that I have heard from anyone in a long time, other than maybe sometimes Elizabeth Warren. I thought he really fucking killed it. It was great.
All
it was exciting for me.
All the top secret debate
that
no one watched.
All the top secret debate
that
everybody claims was an abject failure for everyone. I disagree.
No, I feel like also there's just sort of by comparison, there's like these are like Democratic debates have to offer a sort of more compelling vision and substantive discussion because there are like three people who, whether or not they're insiders or outsiders or whatever, are like really engaged in the business of governing to some degree.
Yeah.
Like, they are professional politicians, but they are also people who sort of, like, are invested for different reasons. So there's a contrast to be made, but there's also, and you can say, I mean, like, there are people that think that just because Sanders obviously like aligns with their positions more, that Clinton's professional politician quality is what makes her a better candidate or whatever. But like, whatever the reason is that you think to vote for someone, like, there is a candidate that offers that reason for voting. And then there's also, you know, a candidate a candidate that offers your perspective.
Yes. You know? Agree. Yeah, I agree. I totally agree.
Which you can't find on the right. You can find everything, but you except for a candidate who seems 100% like they're both qualified and coming from the right place. And, you know, the traditional media kind of described it as Clinton's game because she came out unscathed.
But I don't think she did. I don't think she did either.
Because her biggest gaffe is a thing that on the eve of a terrorist attack really got my goat.
Yeah.
She pulled a Rudy Giuliani.
Sure did.
She was asked about her ties to Wall Street, which is, by the way, a very legitimate question that she should have known was coming because it gets asked of her every 5 minutes.
Right. She went noun, verb, 9/11.
Yep.
Right?
She was just like, first she was like women, and then she was like Wall Street, 9/11. It was like crazy. Here's the exchange. So Sanders basically plugs his lack of a super PAC and the fact that he's privately financed.
And I want to talk about super PACs and campaign finance reform in a second, but let's go over this blunder. Don't let me forget.
I won't. So he talks about him, you know, his financing situation being being less partisan than, or not partisan, less sort of corporate than hers.
Yeah.
She says, well, John, the moderator, wait a minute. He's basically used his answer to impugn my integrity. Let's be frank here. And Mr. Sanders says, no, I have not. And so she says, oh, wait a minute, Senator. You know, not only do I have hundreds of thousands of donors, most of them small, and I'm very proud that for the first time a majority of my donors are women, 60%. That's where she gets women in. Mm-hmm. So I represented New York, and I represented New York on 9/11 when we were attacked. Where were we attacked? We were attacked in downtown Manhattan where Wall Street is. I did spend a whole lot of time there and effort helping them rebuild. That was good for New York, it was good for the economy, and it was a way to rebuke the terrorists who would attack our country. I took money from Wall Street
because of 9/11. Because 9/11. Yeah.
And then also I personally rebuilt Wall Street with my own two hands.
Right. Because
they
9/11. Gave me money.
They gave me money and I went down there because of 9/11
right.
And just brick by brick rebuilt that place.
That's right.
Like,
I mean,
first of all, and that's what that Twitter follow-up was basically like, what do big banks have to do with 9/11?
Well, and that's what I loved, too, because, like, you know, this debate got a lot of good reviews. John Dickerson got good reviews, who was moderating it, but, like, it also got good reviews where a lot of people sort of, like, felt like it was the best use of Twitter social media interaction, because they asked all of them follow-up questions at some point later in the debate, and her follow-up question was from a Twitter rando who was, like, basically just said, did you really just say that you took Wall Street money because of 9/11? And, like, there was, I don't remember exactly what her answer was, but it wasn't great, first off. And also, like, you could literally see a moment, like, if you rewatch that, where she was like, sort of,
what did I say?
Where she had a moment where she was like, is that what I said?
Yeah.
Because I think, actually, when she answered it, she even said something like, well, you know, I'm sorry that you thought that's what I said. Or she didn't say those exact words, but, like, her response was something to the effect, like, well,
I didn't Rudy Giuliani that.
That's not exactly what I said, but
it's literally exactly what she said.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, going back to campaign finance reform, and this is another thing, too, that I felt like Sanders really did well in this debate, better than he has done before, is that I think a lot of people sort of understand that we need to have campaign finance reform, but it's just because vaguely they think that there's too much money in politics. They think about Wall Street giving money, and they think about the Koch brothers giving money. But what I felt like he was really able to do, like, very coherently, was to explain why that's a problem.
Yeah.
Other than just the amount of money. Because, like, you can scare people with, oh, the Koch brothers are going to give $1 billion
and
this
they're
campaign.
Like, what are they
but, like, but you, what does you that
also,
mean?
Right, and also, what and does like, that mean, not just in terms of them having the money to buy advertising, but what do they expect in return for the money?
And that's where I felt like he really sort of, like, hit it out of the park on this one. Because, like, he was able to sort of, like, very, like, you know, like I said, coherently say that, like, if Wall Street or if the NRA or if anyone is giving an amount of money, I mean, you know, and he even said it too, I think, you know, like, you know, 92% of Americans think that we should have background checks on right. guns. But we were unable to get that passed. Why? The only reason that we were able to not get that, or not able to get that passed, was because the NRA literally paid people.
Yeah.
I mean, that's right. what it
and
is.
The, these and, organizations and, are not giving money just out of the goodness of right. their heart. And they expect something
And I
in
had
return.
Never heard him, at least in that powerful a way, explain that. Yeah. And I thought that that really was, that is one place where I would disagree that she came out unscathed, because yeah. I thought she was very
no,
scathed.
Well, frankly, the only thing that. Anyone heard about from this debate was that Rudy Giuliani gaffe.
Well, yeah.
I mean, yeah. she couldn't have come out totally unscathed, because the only thing anyone heard about the debate,
right.
I mean, all of these other things we're about to tell you about the debate were things we had to look for.
Yeah.
But this was the one thing that made the news.
Yeah.
Hillary Clinton made a Rudy Giuliani-style 9/11 gaffe.
Yeah.
That was the headline of that debate.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, it sort of reconfirmed that the Wall Street situation is her biggest liability.
It's
at
a problem
this point.
Because she got really ganged up on when it came to Glass-Steagall.
It's so easy to.
Yeah.
Her husband repealed it.
Yep.
She this summer released some sort of like financial regulation proposal
right.
in the middle of that Benghazi hearing nonsense right. that was like well received, I guess, but nothing special. But she has in no way talked about Glass-Steagall and wanting to reinstate those protections.
Yep.
And that is what Democratic voters want someone to do.
It totally is.
That is.
And I also thought, and Martin O'Malley actually probably maybe even more so than Sanders was able to like very concisely explain why we needed to bring back
yeah.
Glass-Steagall. And she was really on the defensive in that section. And that went on
for a while,
actually, too. Because, I mean, the point of this debate was supposed to be about the economy. Certainly, they dealt with Paris at the beginning of it. But, I mean, like, I really thought that, like, it was not a good night
moment for her.
And I'm biased, but, like, I was trying to watch it with
a lot of people said O'Malley won.
Lens.
And that doesn't matter at all.
No, it doesn't.
That's like having, yeah. you know, Ray Ray
right.
win
I
the
know.
Like,
well, in a classic
Ray Ray's Brenstog, if you have not been following this yeah. podcast for that long.
But, like, in a you know, I will. I
feel bad for the guy.
I, that's what I was just about to say. In a classic Brent Thornburg statement,
right.
you know, I'm
feel
all,
bad
I'm,
for
Martin O'Malley. I'm always feeling bad for everyone. Like, even if they're awful.
Yeah.
Like,
no,
I just,
you felt
know,
bad.
Like,
you've felt bad for Hillary Clinton in the past. You feel bad for Martin O'Malley.
For all of them.
Yeah.
But, yeah,
you're a guy
Martin O'Malley
who doesn't like, lack for sympathy.
Martin O'Malley is a guy who could be president.
Yeah. Right. He's some white guy who's a governor.
Right. Like,
that's a guy.
I feel like he is good enough that, like, this should be a 3-person race.
Yeah. And yet,
and it's just
it's not.
It's really not.
It's wrong year, Martin O'Malley.
Yeah.
You're not the guy.
Yeah.
I feel like also if he, I know that we talk too much about presidential hair, but I feel like he's a guy who is suffering from looking too generic, not just because he is generic looking,
yeah.
but he's like embracing his genericism.
But
if
all
he
of
had
my
a
gay friends
mohawk,
are really like, he's a dope.
Yeah, he's hot. But like, if he had a pink mohawk, I feel like his radical, like he's suggesting some radical things here, and his radicalism would maybe be better received if he didn't look like a Republican.
Yeah, I could see that. Yeah, and yeah, no, you're right. You're right.
Also, there was a lot of conversation also about Bernie Sanders not being good on talking
yeah.
about Paris.
Well, you said something to me
and
earlier
I
that I had not thought
about that.
Which I think is brilliant. So,
well, I'm often brilliant.
Go.
So in any case, most of them ceded their opening statements to Paris, and he kind of like awkwardly mentioned it and then transitioned into the economy as if that like made this very awkward
right.
transition.
He immediately went to sort of like his go-to stump.
Right.
Statements.
And went and started stumping.
Yeah.
And I see why, from a sort of like traditional political standpoint, that was not a smooth move. Because that, you know, we're so used to politicians sort of like blathering on for hours about, you
sure.
know, these fake, you know, talking points that we all have to
yeah.
hit after an attack like this. I think, though, that there is a very different tendency on the far left to not want to privilege certain kinds of violence over other kinds of violence.
Yeah.
So Bernie Sanders is someone who thinks that our foreign policy has led to various kinds of violence. I think that he doesn't get wrapped up in the sort of like emotional, you know, pleas that these politicians make in the aftermath of attacks like this, because the far left really doesn't respond to that. When far left people heard about the Paris attack, they all started posting things about how Beirut had been attacked.
Yeah.
Like, they don't talk about this kind of, these kinds of, you know, tragedies in the same way.
Yeah.
They talk about what do we do,
right.
what's the cause,
yeah.
what's the actual cause. And
yeah.
so I think from his standpoint, his sort of base was not wanting to hear him say a bunch of, you know, insincere things about how we feel for the people of France.
Yeah.
Because that's not action. And that
no.
and action
also,
is what
know.
They want. And we know. Right. Well, that's like, I feel like a lot of political breath gets wasted expressing your sympathy and solidarity with people who, like, obviously we are in solidarity and sympathetic to the people of Paris after a terrorist attack.
Yeah.
Like, it's enough to say it. It's enough to address that you know what happened. But what you want to see is people who are talking about what we need to do, not just to solve that problem, but to sort of solve larger problems that it relates to.
Yeah.
And I think that on the far left, that's something that people don't necessarily need to hear you say on and on about how you're sympathetic to France. That sounds to them like you're about to go to war. So they want to hear that you think economic inequality still needs to be addressed, even if we're going to have terrorism.
Yes.
And that's fair.
I agree.
So I don't know. It's like one of those things where I think a traditional media reads differently than what his demographic reads.
I agree.
So, I totally agree. Whatever.
Yeah.
Also,
certainly didn't bother me.
That's what I'm saying. Like, you didn't watch that debate and think, God, he really doesn't care about the people of Paris.
No.
Like, you were like, this is a man who has plans of things to do. He's not going to let terrorism derail his plans.
Right.
That's what you want.
Totally.
Currently, we're about to let terrorism derail all of our plans.
No.
And we can't do that.
Let's not.
Obama told us not to, and I think that we should listen to him in this situation.
I agree. Yes.
In any case, people were very into John Dickerson.
Yeah.
He really knocked it out of the park. Of course, I would argue that it's a lot less challenging to interview three intelligent people than it is eight loon bags. So, he did ask some good probing questions. Well, first of all, Politico described his questioning as ferret-like, which I think was hilarious. Politico was feeling very spunky, by the way, because Politico also described Hillary Clinton's gaffe as cray-cray in their headline.
I know.
They were like, Hillary Clinton has cray-cray response.
They're like BuzzFeed now or something all of a sudden.
I was like, what are you guys doing? But, you know, he asked a lot of questions that I think were sort of more intelligent questions than a lot of what the Republican field gets asked.
Well, and I think that, like, you know, any debate moderator, where debate moderators can actually be good is obviously, like, keeping everybody in line, but also asking follow-up questions, like, due to their own intelligence. Because any old...
Remembering things.
You could... You can read off a card. You could give any old fool who has like a, you know, fifth grade education like a list of note cards.
Right.
But like, that's not debate moderating.
No, it's like during those Romney Obama debates.
Right, when, Candy Crowley.
Candy Crowley, right.
Right. It's like she had enough information. She had information
in her head to remember facts that she could then be like, but.
And that's what you need as a debate moderator. And John Dickerson had those facts.
Exactly.
So good on him.
And he asked, I mean,
I would contend that anyone doing one of these debates should have those facts.
Yeah.
But.
Apparently, well, also, it's a lot harder to have those facts when there's 10 people on a debate stage.
That's true.
And 50% of them are crazy people that you would not have any current. Like, these are all people who have been in the political realm.
Right. It's easy to remember sane things that people have said.
It's harder to remember all the insane things people have done.
Did Ben Carson say that China was in Syria? Or was that, you know, like, I mean,
is that
like,
a real thing that happened?
How are you supposed to.
Exactly.
You would always be second guessing yourself that these people had said those things.
Exactly.
Because there'd be no way to know.
Well, and so, like, specifically when we talk about him sort of having a memory for things, he referenced a speech in 2004 where Hillary Clinton had said that she could not have predicted the extent to which ISIS would be effective in seizing cities in Iraq, and asked, so you've got prescriptions in the future, but how do we know those prescriptions are any good if you missed this thing that was happening now? Like, questions like that where he kind of like took apart things that they had said in the past. He asked, I think, which I always think is an interesting question, he asked Bernie Sanders, in reference to talking about raising the minimum wage, you know, we know that job losses would be a part of this. Do you think that's a price worth accepting? Which I think is a fair question to ask about the minimum wage conversation. I would contend that it's an overblown problem,
But I thought that both he and O'Malley answered that in a really great way because, you know, as we know, Hillary Clinton only wants a $12 an hour minimum wage. But I think both Sanders and O'Malley rightly said is that, you know, there are a lot of economists out there who think that there wouldn't be job losses because, like, once more people have more money to spend, once they start spending the money on things, then you've got
jobs back.
You've created more jobs.
Exactly.
So, like, you know, there might be a period where that might be the case.
Right.
But, like, once people start spending the money that they have, then...
Well, and also, Sanders is someone who can say and have it be true that he thinks there should be a social safety net so that he talks about a policy that ultimately is for everyone's good, he's not talking about letting everyone fall through the cracks in the meantime.
Well, and he also talked about, you know, he talked about it in a moral sense, which I feel like he is, like, he's good at doing, too. You know, he was like, are we, as the United States of America, is it a moral issue that we, you know, be paying everyone enough that they can work 40 hours a week and then feed themselves?
Exactly.
And I think that, like, that is part of why I love him.
Yeah.
And I think it's part of why a lot of people love him.
He also asked Clinton, because he said, you said Senator Sanders took a vote on gun immunity you don't like. If he can be tattooed by a single vote that ruins all future opinions of him on this issue, then why isn't he right that your vote in Iraq tattoos you forever for your judgment? Which I thought was a fascinating question as well.
Well, and I think Sanders was better on guns this time, too, because he has obviously, like, you know, he was prepared, and he has also released a lot of, you know, plans, and he's, you know, talked about, you know, what we're going to do about, you know, putting people in jail, and, like, you know, I mean, he has sort of, like, a whole package on this, and, like, what I thought was genius that he was doing was he said at least, you know, five times, probably, I think everybody on this stage has pretty much the same stance on gun issues.
Oh, good, yeah.
He kept
we're all, like, the same,
reiterating that, like, everyone up there was, like, and I thought that was actually pretty genius.
The strategy,
and, like, obviously, like, someone had told him to do that, which no one had told him to do anything before the last debate.
So he was just winging. He's been winging it this whole time. He's doing great for a guy who's just winging it.
I know. He was less winging it this time, though. So, but that was a perfect response, I think, actually, too. Like, just sort of, like, casually declaring.
I think we all know we're all the same here.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's meanwhile. So here's the aftermath of all of those debates.
Yes.
Steve King endorsed Ted Cruz.
Yes. Which I said to you, I thought was interesting because, like, and you were like, yeah, he's the establishment. But I was like, yeah, but he's the establishment who, like, only is, like, being elected on his hatred of Mexico.
Right.
So, like, obviously,
in
Donald,
Iowa.
Honestly, Donald Trump is the answer, King.
If your whole platform is hating Mexicans in a place that it has no threat of having tons of Mexicans.
There's one answer.
Then Donald Trump is your guy.
So Steve King, continuing on in his tradition of doing everything wrong.
He's an unpredictable guy.
He really is.
You never know what's going to happen with him.
No, you can't.
So he, and also there was, like, the announcement was so weird because he announced it at a press conference and Ted Cruz tweeted thanks for his support before he had gotten to the point where he was endorsing him. So they kind of stepped on each other. Of course, his support in Iowa in the GOP race is important. It's, he only represents crackpots, so there's not, like, a larger, so
it might help in South Carolina,
it might help in parts of South Carolina, yeah, sure. it's not gonna help in New Hampshire.
Certainly
is what
not.
I'm saying.
No.
And I think,
or anywhere else with thinking people,
or anything else with thinking people, yeah, but it did sort of lead to sort of a larger discussion of what Ted Cruz's quiet strategy has been this whole time. Because while everyone else has been getting all the glory, he's been sort of quietly building a fairly large and in-depth network in all of Iowa.
He's been raising a lot of money that he hasn't spent yet.
Exactly.
We found out that he has more money on hand to spend than any of the other candidates. He's got an organization in every single county in the first four voting states, which was shocking to me.
Shocking.
I would not have thought that at all.
Where did he find all of those people?
So, I mean, he is a person who sort of is, like, positioned well right now, which is
wacko. Here's the thing about him. He's an evil genius. Not genius in the larger sense, but I mean,
genius in the evil genius
sense.
He's
the Harvard debate guy.
Right.
You know, he's not a guy who doesn't know what he's up to.
Yeah.
He's not Ben Carson. He's not wandering oddly and aimlessly through this debate. He's not Donald Trump, who's just really enamored with himself and likes to hear himself talk.
Yeah.
He's a guy with nefarious plans that he has meticulously planned and carried out.
Yes.
Like, that's the guy that Ted Cruz is. That's why he's so scary.
Yeah.
Because he's seems like a lunatic who doesn't have any understanding of the American electorate, except that you know that he's a guy who, like, knows what he's doing.
Yeah.
That's what we've always said about him, is that what's scary about him is not that he's crazy. It's that his heart is not in the right place.
No.
He knows what he's up to, and he doesn't care that it's evil because he's got his eye on power.
Yeah.
Ben Carson's heart is in the right place. He's just crazy.
Yeah.
You know?
Yes.
He's not an evil guy. He just doesn't know.
Yeah.
And I even would contend, after listening to Michelle Bachmann's panel at Politicon, that her heart's in the right place.
She's
a person who's not
who
arriving
know.
At the same facts as the rest of us after reading the same facts as the rest of us. She's taking the facts. She's very well read. She's taking the facts we all know and misinterpreting them somehow.
Right.
That's her problem.
Ted Cruz is taking the facts, interpreting the right way, and then ignoring them.
Right. Figuring out then how they can make him more important.
Right.
Like, that's what's going on. So, but in any case, he's now doing well in the debates. He's now someone who we're sort of on the lookout for his eventual rise in the polls.
Yeah.
He's now someone who has a very important endorsement in Iowa.
You know what? Let's let him win.
And he's someone who would be a great general election candidate for people that aren't crazy.
Exactly.
P.S. Yeah. the Iowa, I mean, the GOP establishment is terrified.
Of course, by this, they hate him.
Because he does not get along with them. No. Yeah, he is in the establishment in that he is a member of the Republican Party and currently in the Senate.
Yeah.
But he's not a guy. He's been throwing them under the bus at every turn he can. He makes them look so bad all the time.
He's like the Bernie Sanders.
He's the Bernie Sanders of the Republican Party.
But a lot of people have been comparing Ted Cruz and Bernie Sanders, Donald Trump Bernie Sanders. But this is maybe a better
comparison.
Comparison. Like, if you're going to go not, there, just because.
But even, Bernie Sanders even cooperates more than he does.
Well,
he's,
totally.
He's the least cooperative senator that they have.
Yeah.
Rand Paul cooperates more than him. And Rand Paul is actually not a Republican, as we know Republicans. Correct. He is a libertarian.
Yeah.
Like, it is crazy to me that Ted Cruz is even being allowed to sort of establish this kind of foothold in the race. But he's an evil genius, and they shouldn't have let him in, because now they have to deal with this nonsense.
Yep.
P.S. Mitt Romney is not running for president.
No.
If you're wondering.
Right.
The GOP has been running. There's been a lot of speculation that they're looking for an establishment guy to jump in.
Well,
because as great as the Marco Rubio thing could be for them, he's very young, he's very boring, it's not clear that he can actually cinch this thing.
There have been a lot of reports recently, and especially even after that last debate too, a lot of people are looking to these debates for, like, someone to be able to sort of, like, especially an establishment person, and you can discuss whether that's Rubio or not, but, like, to have the moment where it's like, oh, this is the person who is the guy, right? Everybody has been hoping that it's going to be Jeb Bush, but he's terrible at debates. So,
in life, right, exactly.
But there have been a lot of reports about Republican insiders and establishment people and RNC people panicking about who's going to end up winning this nomination. Because,
which I can well understand.
I can well understand, too.
Because this is not a great scene they have going on here.
Right, exactly. So, there were some reports last week about sort of like this potential secret redraft Mitt Romney for a third losing campaign.
Oh, poor guy.
But it's not happening.
Nope.
So if you were banking on Mitt Romney being your guy,
Stop that, that's a bad plan.
It's not happening anyway.
Right.
So, like, come up with another plan.
Return to your car elevator. Live to see another day of dressage.
That's right.
In any case, moving on from presidential politics to larger America politics.
Oh, boy.
Things are a mess at the college level.
They
when
are.
It comes to racial tensions and protests breaking out.
I mean, I almost said they're a good mess. They're a good mess
it's
in the sense that,
it's a good
that,
conversation.
Like, it's a good conversation, and and they are making headway here. I mean, it's always great to me to see a protest that, like,
is working.
Get somewhere.
Yeah.
Yeah. And,
yeah.
Like,
and
this
these are protests that started at the University of Missouri.
Yeah.
They were spearheaded by black students who were saying that there were a bunch of racist incidents there, and so they were sort of saying that there's actually like a larger culture of racism that
in
is not
Missouri,
being addressed.
What?
In of all places? In Missouri, a state that I was reading something about the demographic breakdown of Missouri, and it was basically like they have all the like issues of the South and all of the segregation of the North. It's like it's like a mixture of all the worst things of every state.
Yeah, sure.
Well, what a shock. But so in any case, because of these protests, the University of Missouri Systems president, Tim Wolf, stepped down, as did the chancellor, R. Bowen Lofton.
I mean, that's a name.
Right? and then the sort of deciding factor in that situation was that their football team basically said that they were going to stop playing until Wolf resigned.
And that's
which
the
is
end of the
awesome,
world, by the way.
Yeah. Of them to do that.
Yeah, good for them.
Good for them.
Yeah.
You never hear about football teams doing anything, right?
No.
You know?
It's true.
In any case, they sort of sparked a bunch of other protests. You may have noticed last week that there was a trending hashtag Black on Campus. That was actually sort of fascinating. Whereas people talking about various racist incidents they've encountered on campus, either sort of subtle racism or just like open racism, professors saying things that are just like absolutely wrong and that sort of thing. And so a bunch of other schools started having protests, including Yale and Brown and Georgetown. A bunch of very fancy schools jumped into the protest ring. Then everyone started getting on it. Like, now Georgetown students are demanding that they rename a couple buildings that were named
and
after slave owners. Yale, I think, is renaming John Calhoun, a residential building named after John Calhoun, because he was also a slave owner. So now we're renaming all the buildings on campus. And then Chris Christie jumped in, because he was looking for headlines,
obviously,
and said that all these protests are the result of the, quote, lawlessness.
He's going to go back to, like, 1968 style
like,
of,
now
like,
we're
talking about law and order when we were, like, you know, dealing with civil rights protests.
Totally.
I mean, come on, Chris Christie. Get like, your shit together. Do better. Like, I hate you, and, like, I can sort of, like, already think that you're terrible, but, like, right. I also think that you're, like, not a total idiot. And, like, this is, like, this is fucking low. I'm sorry.
I think
he's
an idiot.
Well.
I think.
But I think that he knows what he's invoking he says lawlessness, and I think that he should be smart enough to not do that. But he was trying to get a reaction.
He's a guy who only says things to get a reaction. He doesn't have principles. He just has reactive headlines. It also actually, because there were some counter protests, and
like
there was
Richard Nixon is what he sounds like.
Yeah, that's what he wants to. He's trying to doomsday us into the last century. He's threatening our social security and our safety, and he's talking about terrorism, and he's talking about law and order, and he's trying to make us think that, you know, in fighting for awareness about issues and stuff like that, that we're somehow
he's not talking about universal health care, though, which Richard Nixon was talking about.
Exactly. Anyway. Right. If there's one area in which
we forget.
Oh, speaking of health care.
Somebody is in need of it.
It also, though, because there was this weird backlash on campus, and now there are a couple of campuses are now having some very interesting discussions about political correctness and what it is to have an open dialogue about these issues, which I think has been sort of interesting because it almost like hit a tipping point where suddenly people on the progressive end started being like, wait a minute.
Well, I
and now I'm sort of like, I'm sort of like fascinated in following this conversation to its sort of next extreme. Jonathan Chait wrote something in New York Magazine that was sort of like, we've sort of reached the wrong end of political correctness, basically.
Well, I'm not necessarily in disagreement with that. Like, I think that, like, obviously these are important discussions to have, but I think when we talk about sort of like, you know, renaming buildings, you know, of people who were slave owners, I mean, like, you know, a lot of the founding fathers were slave owners, and I'm not saying obviously that that was right, but I mean, like, you know, are we sort of like going to discount the fact that, you know, Thomas Jefferson is sort of, you know, one of the reasons that we're sort of like, you know, exist as a nation right now? Like, I mean, and certainly like, like, let's have these discussions.
No, but that's, like, I feel like interesting about this is that a lot of the time, I think that the reason people don't have these discussions is because they don't have the language to have the discussions, and that having a discussion about the political correctness thing will maybe at least address that.
Yeah, no,
because
I agree.
Because that's, I think, part of what we need to do to really have these discussions. You know, I've said it before on the podcast, like, white people don't ever talk about being white. We just exist in a privileged state where we never have to think about race. Yeah. And so we go through the world not talking about race because we think that race isn't a thing because it's not a thing for us.
Right.
And so part of the issue with having conversations about race on campus with white people is they don't know how to have the conversation.
Yeah.
And this is part of the learning curve. But having the conversation about what is sort of like productive in the conversation and what isn't is part of the learning curve also for the campus in general. And so I think it will be sort of an interesting thing to follow.
Yeah, I agree.
You know?
Yeah.
I think it'll be sort of, and these are obviously related to deeper seated problems than just that campus buildings are named after slave owners.
Well, right.
That's
exactly.
Not the problem at
Yale. That's not the problem.
You know,
like,
that's a symbolic victory over something that has more to do with the fact that minority students there don't feel that they're being given the same support and treated the same way as the white students. And that's an important conversation to have.
Right, exactly.
Here's another important conversation to have, but that I wish we could stop having at the court level.
No, let's not be having this conversation any longer. Because
the Supreme Court is about to take up yet another case that is going to challenge Roe v. Wade, and it's like, who has time for all of this?
Gosh, I know, right?
This is related to that Texas House Bill 2 that Wendy Davis tried to filibuster.
Yeah.
Go Wendy Davis. Again, something announced on my stupid birthday. Everyone... Get your shit together.
Come on.
It was already Friday the 13th.
Right. And you were having a bad week.
And I was having a bad week already. I was pretty stressed. I just wanted a nice casual birthday.
No.
Where I could just casually hang out and not have terrible news piled upon me.
Well.
And like.
Too bad.
Both the Supreme Court and ISIS.
No, had other plans.
Had other plans.
Yeah.
It's like they fucking teamed up on me.
Yeah.
And that's not what you want, is the Supreme Court teaming up with ISIS.
With terrorist organizations.
That's terrible.
Come on.
It's a nightmare. God. In any case. So this is, they're going to hear a case about whether that law, Texas House Bill 2, is constitutional. This is one of those laws where they require abortion clinics to have, physicians at abortion clinics to have admitting privileges at a local hospital. They require the clinics to have surgical facilities that none of the clinics can retrofit.
And a ton of states are doing this right now. So this would have huge repercussions.
This would have huge repercussions.
Right. If they rule that this was constitutional, then this is basically how you're going to see every state get rid of abortion.
Yeah. Well, and basically what it's going to do, in 1992, they heard a case in the Supreme Court that basically defined the line past which you could not further restrict a right to have abortion as whether it created an undue burden on the patient,
so
on the woman.
So what we're basically going to have to decide what
we're now defining what an undue burden is. And if an undue burden turns out to be nothing, then it's an irrelevant classification.
Exactly.
Yes. So
an undue burden is driving, you know,
5 million miles to the moon and back.
Cross country to California, who's the only state with an abortion clinic still open.
What happened was that a court upheld this law saying that it is not for the court to decide whether what constitutes an undue burden, that that's a legislative decision to make. And that it's fine that this would basically cut down the 42 existing abortion clinics in Texas to about 10, because people can always go to New Mexico.
Yeah, sure.
You know, if people in El Paso can't get abortions, that's fine. They can just drive to New Mexico. That's not an undue burden.
No.
So the Fifth Circuit Court are a bunch of assholes. But so it got bumped to the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
And basically now they are going to have to determine. The undue burden classification came from a case that Planned Parenthood in southeastern Pennsylvania carried out against Casey. It's Planned Parenthood of Southeastern Pennsylvania versus Casey. Usually how it's referred to. But it basically is the moment that they determined that there was an okay way to restrict abortions, and that that was the line.
Yeah.
And according to that definition, an undue burden can be, like, it's fine to require minors to get parental consent, which I would say creates an undue burden, but you can't force them to notify their spouses because they said, like, there is actual, potentially, like, an actual physical danger component that could come from notifying spouses, and that is an undue burden. Yeah. So, if an undue burden is no longer a zillion miles to drive and a clinic with a 500-year waiting list, then we might live in a world where abortion is illegal again, guys.
That's right.
And so, but also, if the whole women's health clinic that brought this case up against Texas, if the ruling comes out in favor of them, then this would sort of define undue limit as, like, you can't cause all the abortion clinics in a state to close.
Right.
Which I think is a fair line.
I think so,
you
too.
You know? Yeah. That's even not fair enough of a line.
Yeah.
But this is going to be very heavily politicized because the ruling is going to come out
at the end of the presidential
season.
Yeah.
So it's going to be shenanigans.
It will be.
Yeah. This is annoying I'm annoyed.
Yeah.
I'm annoyed. Agreed. I'm annoyed. Yeah. Also, here's some casual news that I don't have any information about. Charlie Sheen is HIV positive. Yeah, and now
he's going to
all of Hollywood might be HIV positive because he's slept with everyone.
Yeah, exactly. This is, it's terrible just because, like, I mean, already the articles that have been written about this have just been, like, so terrible. And, like, obviously, like, if he's known about this for years, which supposedly he has, like, if he has been doing things that he shouldn't have been doing, then, like, obviously, like, then that's terrible. And, like, he should be sued. I mean, supposedly he's going to say that he's, like, concerned about lawsuits or whatever. But, like, I mean, this is just, like, this is not... We already don't talk about HIV enough and in a way that is sort of like, you know, when we saw who was the child star who, like, came out and, like, went on The View and, like, you know, everybody was sort of, like, grilling him for, like, you know, do you take responsibility for your actions and blah, blah, blah. You know, we already 30 years later still live in a culture that really vilifies people and has, like, a really terrible stigma about the disease. And, like, if there's one person who's not going to fucking help, it's Charlie Sheen.
So true.
Like,
in Tacoma, I went to an exhibit at the Tacoma Contemporary Art Museum or whatever it is that was about AIDS in art. That was a whole exhibit about that sort of artistically tracked the whole AIDS epidemic.
Oh, that is
West Hollywood featured prominently in their timeline.
I'm sure.
For basically incorporating so that it could provide AIDS treatment.
Yeah.
So that was exciting.
But anyway, so that is sort of like, I mean... the other thing that I think is, like, has been bad about this is that when people are reporting about this is they don't have the information on what sort of, like, being HIV positive
is.
Means
yeah.
now. And
right, because now, like, you can, you know, live, it's sort of
like,
with HIV.
I was going to say, it's always sort of like whenever anybody says what HIV is, it's always like, this is the disease that causes AIDS. And really, if you're being treated now, it's not the disease that causes AIDS.
It's the disease that causes you to take medicine every day.
I think maybe if anything comes from this, it will perhaps... force people to, like, actually look at how they report on this and how they think about this. Yeah. I don't know if it will or not. I don't think it will either.
This is not the person you want as the spokesperson for HIV.
Agree. Which is not the right. Sort of sad.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I hope he is getting the treatment that he needs.
Well, he is, because he's a rich person.
Well, I'm sure that, yeah, exactly.
Like, this is, I feel like, also, guys, if you're a rich person, you don't have to share needles. So, like...
Well, that's the other thing that like, sort of, what, like, makes it, like...
Because right, that, I mean, I think, is how everyone has sort of been speculating that he got it. Because he was an addict and potentially addicting with the wrong crowd. But
is there a right crowd to addict with?
Well, I don't know. A crowd that doesn't share needles might be a better crowd to addict with.
Yeah.
But, like, there are certain safety precautions that are that a rich, educated person at this point in time should know about.
Yes.
That, apparently...
But what I think is important in that, like, obviously, like... should he have made different decisions? Sure. But what I think is important, and so many that doesn't get done enough, is that, yes, I mean, did he obviously make a decision that caused this to happen? Sure. But also, like, everyone makes
bad decisions.
Bad decisions. And, like, it is, he shouldn't, like, you know, I mean, I hate saying this about Charlie Sheen because he's terrible, but I mean, like, let's also not treat Charlie Sheen as a pariah just because, like, he's HIV positive. Like,
I think that Charlie Sheen has done enough other things to earn his pariah treatment.
I agree.
I think that he is the wrong person to be the reason that we start talking about AIDS again or talking about HIV again or talking about any of these things.
But if he is, then great. But I would agree with you.
I mean, but that's... I think that what is sort of frustrating about this conversation is that he is someone who already has a pariah status earned.
Yes.
That... This just further stigmatizes HIV because he has earned his pariah status.
Yes.
It is fair to say that he is a pariah.
Yes.
And it is fair to say that he should have made other decisions for a variety of other things that have led to this moment.
Correct.
It is not fair to say that everyone with HIV should have the same said about them.
Right. Exactly.
But so this is just like going to start a conversation that he has earned that HIV has not earned.
Yeah.
But, you know, yes, like...
I agree. Yeah.
That's... Because I don't think it's fair to say that we should all just not judge Charlie Sheen.
No, let's... Yeah, I agree.
You know? Yes. Like, let's not get crazy here.
Right. We've established that we can do that.
We can judge Charlie Sheen. I mean, the reason that he's talking about also these ramifications happening is because he's been acting irresponsibly with HIV this whole time.
Exactly. And that...
And that is a... And he has a reputation as a womanizer.
Yeah.
He... You know, as a heroin addict, he's already done the things that you don't do once you have HIV just because you're a good person.
Right,
like, he's not a good person.
Right.
So I think it's okay to treat him like a pariah. I think we can know that it's not a helpful conversation about HIV.
I agree. Yes.
In any case.
Hopefully everyone else will also be able to recognize that.
It's like interesting to live in a world where HIV is something that Charlie Sheen gets as opposed, like, it's not like... It's not, like, a world anymore where HIV belongs to, like, a minority.
Well, yeah.
You know, it's...
Yeah.
HIV is a different disease now than it was in the 80s and in the 90s because it's a disease that ravages Africa and takes Charlie Sheen, you know, like, it's... it's...
Yeah.
That's... If there's one thing... Because I was thinking about this a lot as I was looking at, you know, as I was at this exhibit. This exhibit in Tacoma, because obviously so heavily focuses on the gay experience with AIDS and HIV, which is understandable. And, you know, specifically interesting to me because a lot of the art was about and had come from the neighborhood I grew up in. Not Chelsea, but in the East Village. And so it was sort of just like an interesting sort of reflection of the world I had grown up in to some extent that I was not... aware it was happening, but was also, like, happening around me.
Yeah.
But to sort of, like, in thinking about now just, like, what HIV is to the regular general person as compared to, like, how kind of close that experience was in the 80s and 90s, is sort of fascinating to think about.
Yeah, I bet
it was. Because this is a whole different conversation to have about AIDS. This is not a conversation that stigmatizes gay men.
Correct.
It's not. It's a conversation that stigmatizes Charlie Sheen a little bit. but I mean, this is not... Charlie Sheen having AIDS does not suddenly make us think, well, gay men need to... You know, like, that's not the conversation anymore.
Yeah.
So, that's something to know.
That's true. You're right.
We finally have gotten there.
Important note.
Important note. Yes. In any case.
That's what we'll end with.
We'll end with AIDS.
By the way. This is a long podcast.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Had a lot to talk about.
Well, because of terrorism. Guys,
terrorism.
If we didn't have to talk about terrorism...
We talked about the Democratic debate for a long time, too, but that was important
that's
stuff,
our wheelhouse, though.
Right.
This terrorism is not our... we don't want to have to tell you about terrorism.
No, stop terrorizing people.
Don't terrorize people, and then we won't have to go on for an extra half hour about terrorism. That's the worst. In any case, we'll be back next week, hopefully with solely domestic news.
That's
we
what
can
we're
only
for.
Hope.
Yeah.
We're looking forward to nothing happening in the world.
That's right.
But have a good week, nonetheless.
That's
Bye.
Bye.